You can hear our show on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, or Palm phones. On demand and on the go. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. You're watching Fanboy Versus with your hosts, J.D. Church, Nicole Hale, Chris Triplett, and Chris McFeely.
And you are watching Fanboy Versus. I am your host, J.D. This week it is Nicole Hale, Chris Triplett, Chris McFeely. Welcome, gang.
Hi.
So, it is Fanboy Versus Public Opinion as we delve into the world of rights, copyrights,
litigation,
capitalism, all those awesome things.
Coming up tonight, also comics.
And comics as well. So
we swear, don't go anywhere.
It's not there. All serious shit. Yeah. Some of it's fun.
Yep.
You know?
So, and I'll just quickly mention, hopefully some of you may have listened to our Toy Fair coverage. Hopefully you enjoyed that. There is a little bit of comic stuff out of that. There was a lot of Marvel figures that were announced. I know that not maybe as much excitement for the American audience, but for the British audience, everybody's going apeshit over Death's Head.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
So
that's going to be like one of the little figures, like the three-quarter top figures, right?
If it's a figure, yes. Right now, it's just a CGI model. Oh. So we'll see what... I assume that will still come out, though, but we'll hope. I think the DC Direct stuff, I didn't get to look at it today, but there are a few things I got to look at, but there are some DC Direct figures as well, so... And I think Matty Collector actually announced that they're going to be releasing some of the Justice League Unlimited figures. Really? So that's something you can pay more than they're worth for. stuff. Because we all love Matty Collector. And he loves kicking you in the balls. So, on that note, let's go to Chris McFeely to get us in on the news.
The news. Oh, boy. Okay, right. There's a couple of bits and pieces we want to get through before we hit the big stuff for this week. So let's. It's almost like DC this week, except for the big bad news. So let's get the pleasant stuff out of the way first. We've had a couple of announcements and glimpses of things from DC. We've seen the covers for World's Finest Number 1 and Earth 2 Number 1. Power Girl has a new costume design with no boob window.
I noticed that.
That's news. No,
that's sacrilege. Like, what are they doing?
Yeah. What will nerds fap to now?
I mean, how am I gonna know?
She still has them.
How am I gonna know that's Power Girl now? She looks like
I know. She could be anybody.
She needs a circle in her chest. She needs it.
The interesting thing about the cover is, though, they're superimposed behind them in the background are images of, like, a Supergirl and a female Robin, implying that the new Earth 2 Power Girl and Huntress might have started out their careers as these characters and done it legacy hero style. Other implications to take away from it is the variant cover to Earth 2. It shows Batman, Wonder Woman, and Superman. So this is not just a second generation Justice Society, Green Lantern, Hawkman, Wildcat type deal. We do have the Earth 2 versions of the big three as well. But the interesting thing is that Batman is using Eskrima sticks, which are typically Dick Grayson's weapon, Nightwing's weapon. So the question becomes then, is this adult Dick Grayson from Earth 2 in the role of Batman? And if that's true, does that mean this is the missing Donna Troy as Earth 2 Wonder Woman?
Does it also mean that they're going to go... Well, and if Huntress is there, right, are they going to go back to the original Huntress? Because Huntress was originally supposed to be Batman, the daughter of Batman and Catwoman.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's Earth 2, so one would assume that would be the whole point of it. You know, if we've got to the point where these characters have grown up and taken on the Batman, Superman, whoever Superman might be, you know.
I think I need to buy this book now.
Yeah, I'm officially interested. And they're fighting parademons on the cover as well, so who knows?
I cannot find this cover. Where's it?
Oh, no, this is, it's on the Source, DC's blog.
The Source, okay. That's why I'm like, God, I can't find it.
So when does this come out?
This is not out until May.
Now, this is the book Perez is drawing, right?
Perez is drawing World's Finest.
Oh, World's Finest, yeah.
Nicola Scott, she of Secret Six, is drawing Earth 2.
Okay.
But the cover art, this variant cover, is by Evan Rice, currently drawing Aquaman.
Cool.
That looks like Power Girl. I don't have to have her tits hanging out.
She needs like a pee on her chest or something. That way I know it's Power Girl.
You don't need a pee on a girl's chest.
Sorry, I heard that.
A whole other thing.
Whole different thing.
Oops. That came out wrong.
So, moving tactfully on.
That's the quote of the week.
Well, speaking of another big load of pee, Smallville, season 11.
Woohoo.
Yeah, what is up with that? Why are they making a comic that's following the events of Smallville?
DC have announced Smallville Season 11 as a weekly digital comic, which will then be collected in print editions. Why?
It does a couple of things. For one, it gives them an opportunity to test the waters for digital only. And it gives the, you know, fans of Smallville more stuff, I guess.
But it doesn't give them Smallville. It gives them
Superman.
And if you want people to be reading Superman, shouldn't you be pointing them at your Superman books?
No, I
would say the audience for this book would be sorely disappointed if 20 out of the 22 pages weren't two characters standing back to back in a barn.
Yeah. And now that we're not, like, you know, waiting for him to put on the costume and fly.
What the fucking point?
I see what you're saying.
So what is he gonna do? Is he gonna, like, fly back to Smallville and then not be Superman for, like, an issue? And then, like, the end of the issue, he goes back to Metropolis? And then, like, the next issue, he flies back at the beginning?
Continued in Superman number one. Yeah.
So that's a thing that's coming out. But hey, it's digital, so, you know.
Yeah, well, another announcement we had was that IDW are actually going to do a Doctor Who and Star Trek crossover.
Somewhere Joe Ibe is fapping.
Holy damn. The question, I mean, the cover image shows Dr. Amy and Rory on the deck of the Enterprise, but could they do more Doctors and multiple Enterprises?
That would be awesome.
You know,
we need a fourth Doctor on the original Enterprise. That would be great.
So, like, is the Doctor going to travel back and, like, prevent Kirk from dying in such a stupid way or something?
That would be great.
Is the Doctor going to meet up with other Doctors who may be older than him?
No.
That's the Blinovich. that is the Blinovich limitation effect. You can't cross your own personal time stream.
Right.
But Star Trek,
except
they did.
In the two
Star
Doctors,
Trek, not Doctor the, Who.
Except in the two Doctors, the three Doctors, and the five Doctors, and the Christmas, charity.
What's really going to happen is they're going to do the Tribbles episode again with DS9. And the Doctor's going to be there. That's what's going to happen.
As well, yeah.
I would buy that.
This is fanfic-orific.
That's pretty funny right there.
It really is, and this will be the first real time that the BBC have allowed this to happen. Because, I mean, but the fact is, I can sit down and I can talk about this, but odds are very good that I won't be able to read it.
Right.
Huh.
It will not be released over here, because IDW don't have the license to release the Doctor Who comics over in the UK, ridiculously.
Yeah, that won't happen.
So, that's another thing. And then another
thing.
Well, I don't even think we have any kind of date on that one. Oh, May, apparently, is the date for that one. So, what's this? This is in March, April, May. We might see that in the next solicits, then. So the next one, and this is a precursor to where we're going for our big talk in a few minutes, is the news that Tony Moore, the artist of the original six issues of The Walking Dead, has sued Robert Kirkman, author of The Walking Dead, over money. What else?
Really? I haven't heard about this one.
Yes, he's claiming he's not receiving the money he was promised, and that he is being forbidden access to the books to verify that fact. Kirkman has dismissed the whole thing as ridiculous, and we have seen a few different creators take different sides in the on the blog affair. But it seems like something that could be settled fairly quickly with a simple examination of the books in whoever's favor the books may speak to. It's just depressing. The whole litigation. I mean, it's like we didn't have enough fanboys bellowing and belly aching about corporations versus creators last week with the news of Watchmen 2.
Mm-hmm. it's really crazy this is happening now because, like, Walking Dead's coming back tonight.
Oh, it's coming back tonight over there. Yeah.
For us, yeah, we're getting it back tonight.
I understand that it's more like The Crawling Dead as far as the plot is.
Oh,
going.
Shut up. Hey, if you've ever read the comic is The Crawling Dead also. It takes you 10 issues before something happens. It's just the way it's always been.
What is this, Dragon Ball Z?
Yes.
Zombies. It's zombies.
Dragon Ball Z with zombies.
Rick Grimes spends 10 issues talking about how he's going to beat Vegeta. That's exactly what it's about.
That zombie is going to take 10 minutes to get over here. 5 episodes past. Okay, so that there's not much to talk about on that on the litigation for agreements were signed, both parties were lawyered up at the time. This seems like something that should be settled fairly quickly, albeit depressingly. Mm-hmm. So it is precursor to the big news that has everybody wagging fingers and having an opinion this week, which is the news that Gary Friedrich, co-creator of Ghost Rider, who began a legal battle with Marvel following the release of the first Ghost Rider movie in 2007, I believe, sued for proceeds, for royalties, for use of the character in the film on the basis that he created them. It was confirmed this week that he has lost the case, and Marvel, who countersued, Marvel countersued him, and he has lost the case and is now eligible to pay $17,000 to Marvel. Gary Friedrich is a 69-year-old bankrupt who was recently let go from his job as a courier.
Yeah.
Now, when one phrases the news story like that, one can understand why the immediate response from so many people is, evil faceless corporation destroys life of creators' rights, etc., etc. So let's break this down. JD has and I have spoken about this. He's watched me talk about it at length.
It was awesome
on Twitter.
Oh, so great.
So is there supposed to be some video somewhere I need to watch where McFeely's just going crazy about this something?
Just on Twitter, and it's all quite measured and orderly. I've talked about it in a couple of different forums, the deal is, Friedrich, first of all, alleges that he created Ghost Rider. Ghost Rider editor Roy Thomas and the artist Mike Ploog tell a different story that paint a much greater co-collaboration between them, and that he, as co-creator, is not entitled to any sole creator credit. Oh, that's another thing that the judgment has been, which is that Friedrich is not allowed to claim himself as the creator of Ghost Rider for credit. Because the idea of him being sole creator is in question. I lost my thought process. So it is ruled that Gary Friedrich created Ghost Rider as work for hire for Marvel, and hence Marvel owns the character, and Friedrich does not and cannot claim for royalties on him because he created the character for Marvel and forfeits any rights to him by the nature of that. It's the standard contract for Marvel. Admittedly, DC does actually pay royalties to creators of characters. Len Wein has made more money off of Lucius Fox than Wolverine.
Marvel, DC, any Lowe's, Apple, Microsoft, any company.
That's the thing, any company, any collaborative company like that, advertising, Google, graphic design, software, marketing, you create collaborative fiction, you know, it's like, this is work. That's how it works. The company you work for that pays you for your ideas owns your ideas. Now, whatever feelings you may have about work for hire, and this was the nature of the discussion I was having, and is in fact really, to be completely honest, the fuel to a lot of the fanboy ire. I keep saying fanboy like it's a demeaning term. It's just the word that's coming to mind because of the name of the show. Fan ire. The thing that's causing fans the ire. Is
for this week, we renamed the show Fan Ire versus...
Fan ire. Fan versus
is that, that Friedrich should be owed something. But per the contract he willfully signed, he isn't. Now, obviously, you get into the argument about how creators win their rights by fighting for them and what have you. You know, in the recent few years, we've had Jack Kirby's estate and Siegel and Schuster's estate fighting for Kirby's creations and Superman. In the case being that
that's
Kirby...
a different thing, though.
Well, no, Kirby was proven to be work for hire.
Okay, but not Kirby, not the segment. I'm going back to the Superman.
Yeah,
Superman
they did previously create Superman and did shop him around, but it was proven that DC purchased the rights to the character.
Right. So they had a different case, though, because that went way back before the work for hire and stuff. But anyway.
Well, yeah. And work for hire is, there's a legal and there's legal and there's ethical here. And frankly, everything legally here is fine. Ethically is where it starts to get a little wobbly. I mean that the statement that waived rights was printed on the back of a check that he had to sign to endorse it to get the money for the job he did in the first place, which sounds scummy, but really, it's not as if he entered the job not understanding the nature of the work. And he signed a subsequent agreement to it later in the 70s as well, on the understanding of subsequent freelance work.
So has there actually been like a lot of kind of discussion about whether he does own the character? Because I never saw that as the issue. It's like 100% Marvel owns it. I always thought it's like the issue that, hey, Marvel is like going after this old man that,
but,
you know.
Well, yes.
Well, see, now,
and that's
your
the case.
Of words there is the interesting one. Marvel have gone after nobody.
No.
He went after them. And right. their countersuit is based on the fact that he was provably, willfully breaking copyright by selling prints of official Marvel Ghost Rider art without either Marvel's permission or Mike Ploog, the artist's permission. That is the factor that is being downplayed by a lot of internet pundits to make this sound more like Evil Faceless Corporation slaps down poor broke creator instead of copyright infringer punished for breaking law.
Yeah. Right.
And there's a lot of people who are being very alarmist, claiming that this could be the end of artist alleys and conventions and everything because these characters all draw licensed Marvel characters. But no, the whole point is characters and artists in artist alleys draw one-off sketches for people, and there's a sort of tacit understanding that it improves relations, that it supports the artists, it helps the brand altogether. Friedrich was selling mass-produced, mass-produced, we don't know quite the quantities we're talking about, but copies of official finished Marvel artwork that was not his to sell. He didn't create it. He didn't even create it. He wrote the story that was inside the cover that he was reproducing, but he did not create the art and had no place doing that. And 17,000, and that's the other thing, 17,000 is the settlement. I mean, it's crazy the idea that he agreed to settle on that fee and to not claim to be the creator anymore. But that is the settlement. This is not something that was forced upon him. This was not the ruling of somebody. This was the settlement that his lawyers and Marvel and Disney's lawyers settled upon. Legally, nobody has... Friedrich, I have used this allegation elsewhere, poked the bear while wearing a suit made out of raw salmon.
Ooh, you don't want to do that.
He had legally, he had no leg to stand on.
No.
Because the courts didn't roll over for Jack fucking Kirby, creator of the cornerstones of the Marvel Universe. They weren't going to roll over for the creator of a pissant character like Ghost Rider.
Aww.
You know,
I like Ghost Rider.
But, you know, let's talk about the larger implication here, which is that when it really comes down to it, this is a system that works. And the reason it works is because these companies take a gamble that the writers and creators and artists that they hire are going to be able to produce marketable work. How many times do they put out shit that does not sell?
And the I'm company still betting on the Nightwatch movie.
Yeah, I mean,
awesome.
So, you know, it's a risk for the company. And these writers, it's not like they had the money and market power on their own to produce these products, right? So they're going to a company and saying, I have skills. And the company says, we're going to hire you for your skills, and you're going to create stuff for us. That's the agreement. That's the way it works.
It's an explicit agreement as well. This is not guys entering the industry who don't know what they're getting into. Now, does it suck? Yes.
No!
You know, well, does it suck for the creator is what I'm saying.
They got lucky. They won the lottery, okay, in the sense that the thing that they made happened to make it big, right? But they did that under the agreement and understanding that they were taking that they were working for a company, and the company was the one taking all the risk. Therefore, the company should be the one to reap the reward because they invested in it. The creator didn't invest in it. They were getting paid and working for the company.
Well, I can't say that I'm in favor of the notion that the creator is owed nothing. I mean, I'm not saying that I feel the creator should retain, as per the nature of the argument I was having on Twitter, which really got off the point, but descended into an argument over the nature of creators' rights. The idea that the creator retains sole control of the character and vets the stories they appear in is functionally unworkable in the comic book world. In a shared universe of comics where Batman is appearing in a dozen comics every month with other characters whose creators will then have to vet their appearances and so on and so forth. It's functionally not workable. But DC has a system in place where creators of characters do receive royalties for those characters' uses in other media. And, you know, I'm saying, like, that Marvel doesn't. You know, that sucks, but was the way that the system worked at the time. And
it's cool that DC wants to do that, but they're under no obligation to do that. Because, again...
Certainly not. No, no.
You know, the fact that a character that gets created ends up lasting and having larger appeal is a gamble. You know, that's not something that happens every day. And there are tons of characters that are created every day that disappear into the mythos. I mean, how many one-off characters, you know, somebody creates a character and it gets put in a book and then you never see that character again. And that's the company taking a risk. You know, a creator is saying, hey, I want to try this character out. It gets tried out. It gets put in a book. Sometimes it gets multiple one issues. Never turns into anything. And the company doesn't reap that money back. You know, that's money that's lost. Where they make it back is the other characters that get made and do make money. And, you know, it was their risk to make, it's their risk to gain. That's just how it works. I mean, like you said, again, is it programming, anything that's... And it's collaborative. We're totally missing the part where this is collaborative as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Roy Thomas and Mike Ploog tell a different story, the nature of Ghostwriter's creation. Gary Friedrich claims he brought the idea to Marvel fully formed. Roy Thomas and Mike Ploog tell the other story of how the idea was developed through collaboration with them once he had brought it to them, and that Friedrich wasn't even the originator of the Flaming Skull motif. And it's like, who retains the right? So what part of it? I was in another podcast, I heard somebody make also the very good point, which is, I didn't know what you're saying, JD, which is like, how much of any kind of character's appeal is rooted in what the original creator does in the first place. Nobody is going to hold up their hand and say that Wolverine's appeal, for instance, is based on the two-part Hulk story that Len Wein did featuring him, and not everything Chris Claremont, Dave Cockrum, and Frank Miller did with the character a few years later. You know, that. Right. So who gets the credit? You know, that's where these things... and that's the nature of comics. I mean, you know, when you talk about work for hire, I mean, some of the example I've seen thrown out as far as work for hire goes was like with novels or video games or whatever. And if it is the product of one sole person's mind, and then it's owned by a corporation, and then no, that one sole creator can't make any more. It's like, yeah, that does suck, really. Yeah, the fact that nobody else had any input into it and whatever. But yeah, with comics specifically, there is no other way for the medium to work.
No, this is the read the fine print. This is the thing that pisses me off. People who are artistic or whatever, great, fantastic. You wrote a novel. You created a universe. But if you sign those rights away, if you sign a contract that says, I'm signing the full rights to this universe away to X company, you sign that document. If you don't like it, write a better document. Or don't sell it. Or wait for a better deal. You know, I don't like this idea of creators and artists trying to say, I created this idea, therefore I implicitly own the idea throughout. That's not how our system works. It's just not how it works. If you sign a contract and sign those rights away to a company, they own it. That you got the money. You got compensated for it.
And, you know, admittedly, sometimes it may not be what you want to have to do, but, you know, kids need fed, roof needs fixed.
Yeah, and you don't get to get that back. I mean,
admittedly here, Friedrich was working on a potential loophole, which was that Marvel did not file the copyright for Ghost Rider upon receipt of the character back when. But I was hoping to then exploit that with the notion that the rights should have reverted to him in the early 2000s as a consequence. But I believe it was proven that by publication of the issue,
right,
Marvel's rights to the character were secured then anyway. Right. So it's not as if he was just blindly attempting to make this case. He thought he had something going on there. But he's fought this for 6 years, five or six, no, hang on, what's two? Yeah, five years now, coming on 5 years. And, you know, he's basically sunk all his money into it, and here he is now owing $17,000, which is... Because and he owes the $17,000 because he wore a sort of raw salmon to the freaking bear poking contest.
Yeah, and you know, everybody's like, oh, he's a poor, you know, artist, he's bankrupt, whatever. That's not Marvel's fault.
Nope. I mean, it's an it is.
It's just a bad situation. You know?
It is.
All
it
around.
Is.
There's nothing good, you know, about this for either side, and it just
no.
But I don't.
Comes well, out no, as crap. Know,
Steve Niles, horror writer Steve Niles, has set up a fund where people can donate to help Gary. And I don't have any problems with that. I don't begrudge anybody because you know he needs money for what if he needed $17,000 to stop his house falling down, if he needed $17,000, whatever, you know, it's a struggling creator with no money who needs some money. And if you've enjoyed his work, feel free to go ahead and donate. Absolutely, no question. Do understand when you're doing it that you are donating to a man who, in essence, made his own bed in this scenario, and that there is this is conjecture, but there is a very strong chance that the money you are putting in will be used to further this case. He's going to appeal. He said he's going to appeal. So there's a very good chance that whatever money you're giving to him will now be used to press this case, this unwinnable scenario,
even further. Something further that he was breaking the law doing to begin with.
Yes.
I mean, So again,
well, that matter is settled, and he owes that money or whatever. I mean, to be honest though, Marvel are probably never going to come after that money because it is going to take more money to come after that when he actively doesn't have it. And when you get into the subject of legal versus ethical, ethically, it'd be nice if they could just cut the poor old guy a break. Legally. Yeah. They can come after it if they want.
But it's just like IP. It's just like any. It's like we talk about, you know,
yeah,
with
it's
anything.
Simple protection
they
of their IP.
They have to protect
IP,
their
yeah.
IP, you know. And I
there
can't
is
just...
the there is the vaguely unsettling. Well, there's three things. It's like, does it seem like a slightly punitive amount? Yeah. Does it seem a bit pointless given that that's a real drop in the bucket to Disney?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there the slightly nasty overtone of this that it does kind of feel like in this increasingly litigation-fraught industry, he's being made an example of? Kinda, yeah. But, like, on legal ground, everything here is on the up and up. Nobody is actually in the wrong here as far as this judgment has gone. You know, Friedrich's claims are questionable. Marvel's aren't. in that he broke the law, copyright infringement. And in fact, you mean they seem perfectly happy to let it be for as long as it was until he came after them. Mm-hmm. And as I say, pundits are downplaying a lot of the elements that make Friedrich look bad in this, so it can look like, you know, a sob story. Ty Templeton, writer-creator Ty Templeton, did a very good short comic strip on his website just earlier today, which sums up the major beats. His position is, again, you know, it's a shitty scenario. It sucks, and it sucks that, indeed, this financial fate is one that awaits many freelancers and work-for-hirers, but that's the way the industry is. But that Marvel is not being a monster in this scenario either. No. And it is a lot of misplaced. And, you know, I can understand that. As I say, I support creator rights. I would like to see DC's policy be Marvel's policy, mm-hmm. so that these guys do get some reward for what they do. But, you know, when you sign a contract and you know it's not. That's just the way it is.
But it's just like I said.
There's a lot of people who are white knighting this and acting like he's not in the wrong, like somebody's in the wrong when nobody is. This is all agreed upon. And Friedrich took a shot. He sued. He lost. He pays the penalty. It's not hard to understand.
I still say that these creators are not footing the bill when they, you know, pitch that this first issue of whatever story it is going to do great, and then it fails miserably.
And well, that's why nobody launches new IPs anymore.
You know, yeah, I mean, it just, you know, it's not like how many failed ideas do these creators have before they have one that hits, and they're not paying the cost of production and marketing for those things. So, you know, they're certainly not fighting to say, well, I guess I better pay you back for all the work that I did that absolutely failed. You know, they definitely want that paycheck when it cashes in.
And, you know, because he made a play for it whenever it had succeeded. You know, Ghost Rider was never a success under him. It was only in the 90s, really, that Ghost Rider became a success. And it was after the film that, you know, once Marvel had finally had their real payday off of Ghost Rider, that he went, oh, hello, I created that.
Oh, hey, I need money now.
Yeah. Into that. Yeah. You know, it's like all or nothing, you know. You didn't catch you fighting for your rights for it for the last 30.
We have a question in the chat. Golden Bixby asked, could a more digital or non-print comic help with the no IP thing?
Not if you're producing it under the company.
Well,
for Marvel.
And that's the point I was about to make, which is that, you know, these companies, DC, Marvel, there's going to be a little bit of a changing landscape. Not a lot, but a little bit. I mean, indie comics has been something that's very difficult to do. It's hard to be able to print, produce, create, you know, comics up till even, you know, 2 years ago. But we're getting into a world now where, you know, it's easy to find these companies online to be able to create your own product. Kickstarter is making, like, Kickstarter is totally changing the landscape because, you know, creative teams can
tell
the
folks at home what Kickstarter are, Jeannie.
Kickstarter is a website that basically tries to hook up people that want things, you know, want certain kinds of creative products with the people that create those. So, you know, a good example it would be,
that Double Fine game that Psychonauts? That was Kickstarter, wasn't it?
Yes, a group of creators that are wanting to make a video game. So they pitch their video game, you know, on Kickstarter. And basically, you know, usually the way it's done is depending on how much you contribute is how much you get in when it initially pays off. You know, there's basically like a time limit and all this kind of stuff that goes into it. But the end of the day, it's a way to contribute in a sort of pre-order way to creation of creative products. This is not going to, but in a way it's changing that landscape a little bit. Because creators are going to be able to go to the public and say, this is what we want to make. If you want to invest in it, here's your opportunity, and then you're going to be in the ground floor of this thing or whatever. And then they're going to own that product as well. I mean, as far as the creators go, because they're self-publishing it, it's going to be their product. You know,
and never mind Kickstarter. I mean, we just have the internet. The internet,
well,
in many reasons, it's part of why you don't see anywhere near as many original IP. People hold on to their original ideas, really, now. Because they have so many venues to self-publish under now.
Yeah.
In the last 2 years.
Still doing, the stuff where they hold on to their stuff when they go into Image. I mean,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Marvel have the Icon imprint specifically for creator-owned material, which is basically Mark Miller and Powers. is basically all of that puts out Mark Miller's various projects and Powers. But Image is frankly, I think this year Image is kind of the company to watch because they've been progressively launching these quite lauded new projects over the last year. And this year we're seeing Jonathan Hickman's new series, and Brian K. Vaughan is back in comics with Image this year with his new series as well. So Image, Image is probably the ones to really pay attention to. They're the ones that seem to still be pushing original ideas in a market where Marvel is trying to hem in all the extraneous stuff and focus on their core brands, and DC is making grabs like what before Watchmen, you know, marketing existing concepts.
You know. But in a lot of cases, you have to pay your dues to do that, and if you're going to do that, you're going to have to do a work for hire, and you're going to have to probably work for a larger company before you can, you know, have the market appeal to do that. It's a system that works. It has worked. You're really talking about dismantling the entire way that corporate creation works to try to go back to this creator-owned, because there are so many more products, creations, not just comics, but programs, other things as well, that fail. And that's why these companies have these work-for-hire, because they never know what's going to make it and what's not. And if they try to let the creators retain all the rights to it, you know, again, even under, you know, say if it's a creator-owned system, you know, there's nothing that those products aren't going to pick up and move when the creator moves, you know?
Yeah.
You know, one week you've got your story with Batman and Superman. The next week you've got your story with Batman and Spider-Man, just because, you know, they move around. What happens when they die? What happens to those creators? There's all, and that was some of your discussion on Twitter, and it's just...
Yeah, which was the idea that it would end with the death of the original creator.
Which is this particular individual,
which is, yeah.
You know, there's the, you know, I don't know. Anyway.
Then you're just leaving it up to the whims of fate.
Yeah. It's, you know.
But to pull it back around to the whole Friedrich thing, you know, I legitimately feel bad for him. You know, it's not a situation anybody wants to be in. It is unfortunately a situation that a lot of freelancers may wind up in. It's unfortunate for him. It is a situation of his own making.
Yeah. I feel bad for him in a crazy sort of way. Like, dude, you be crazy.
Yeah, there is a sense of, you know. You got to feel bad for him as well, because you really have to question his legal counsel in this.
Mm-hmm.
Who sat down with this man and said, "Yes, Gary, this is a good idea"? Who said, "Yeah, sue Disney, that'll work"?
Yeah, we're gonna take on Disney and Marvel.
Yeah, and that will. Yeah, you know. Gary, you say you're a brick copyright infringement. They'll never find that out. No, Gary, come on. We'll totally go ahead with this. You know, you do have to, like, legitimately wonder who was representing him in this case that actually thought it was a good idea to press ahead with this. There's a lot of fault on all sides. It's mostly Friedrich's fault, frankly. Marvel is not at fault in this judgment. This was the judgment of a judge. Friedrich is trying to appeal it so that it may be brought before a jury. But I don't think anybody sees that happening, because he doesn't have a legal leg to stand on. I would like it if Marvel would, you know, I don't think Marvel will come after the money. I would like it if they didn't push the issue, if they would just let the poor old guy go and just let it be, if they can raise, you know, if fans can raise the money to allow him to have his life. You know, fair enough. You know, but
so be sure to send
Marvel
all your...
is not the faceless beast in the corporation that a lot of websites and news reports are making it out to be.
No, so be sure to send all your hate mail to Brian at tfradio.net, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from you. So, well. Anything else in the news?
Wow. No, that's the news today. Yeah. So
I was going to mention that we got the Amazing Spider-Man trailer, but I don't really think we can follow that up with all of that.
Yeah, that happened.
That is a thing that happened. And the Avengers Super Bowl
trailer, yes.
Yeah.
So that happened as well, which seemed to have Frost Giants in it, but okay. So, all right.
Yeah. Comics, then.
But comics, then. So, Chris Triplett, dear God, save us.
Damn, why do I have to be first after that buzzkill? Jeez.
Very exciting.
You handle it so well. You're so happy with life.
But hey, guess what? Wolverine and the X-Men number 5 came out. And this book is good. It's fun. And I know I talk about this book a lot. And the reason I talk about it so much is because it's awesome. You guys should be buying it. Why aren't you buying it? JD, give me a valid reason. Why are you not buying this book?
I'm poor.
That's not good enough. Okay.
Oh, okay.
McFeely, why are you not buying this book?
X-Men, big universe, crossovers.
I give up. Whatever. But no, this book's awesome. And it's just like, I mean, just continuing the same stuff. It's just, hey, they opened up a school, they're teaching the kids, and just hilarity ensues.
Hey, I'm following the school on Twitter. Does that count?
Is the school on Twitter?
Oh, daily updates from the school with, like, who's making lunch and all kinds of what classes are late for what reason. Bobby was doing the updates there for, like, a week or two, which was hilarious. His Twitter handle is IceIceBobby.
That makes sense.
Oh, that's fantastic. Kind of,
because in this issue, basically to build the school, Wolverine got the help from Angel, because Angel's company, you know, Worthington Industries, is funding it. But some crap went down with Angel, and he sort of lost his mind, and he's crazy.
In Uncanny X-Force.
Yeah, that wasn't even in this comic. It was like something happened in like X-Force, and he actually thinks he is an angel now, and not a mutant, but an actual angel, like angel.
Question: does he have feather wings, or is he back to the?
He's got robot wings, I think.
Metal wings.
Oh.
Okay, because I saw.
They still call him Angel, but he looks like Archangel in some issues.
I saw one of the teasers for the Avengers versus X-Men, and it had him and Daredevil going at it, and he had the metal wings. Yeah. And I was like, really? When did that happen?
It must have happened
for a while. Must have been the Dark Angel saga. Mm.
Well, there was
did
a
he get it, or did he lose his wings for a while? I'm going to look that up for you.
There was a thing a while back, and I don't know when it happened, but like he could change or something. Like he could have like normal wings, and then I think he could be like Archangel or Angel. I don't know. It sounded really stupid, so I don't know how it happened, but I overlooked that. You know, I just like, oh, he's got metal wings, he thinks he's an angel, you know. But so like the company.
Okay, well, I've got it here. His wings were ripped from him by a mind controls Wolfsbane early in X-Force, and then it was revealed by Elixir that his wings were still techno-organic constructs, and so he wasn't able to heal them. Because he developed a healing power as a secondary mutation way back when. I remember that. Yeah,
I remember that.
Yeah, and then Purifiers...
Had wings again? That he just had robot wings underneath him, or something?
Well, the idea that happened was that he had his metal wings from Apocalypse, and then it was like, I think it was in the mid '90s, thereabouts, mm-hmm. mid to late '90s, where they molted, and it was revealed that he had the feathered wings underneath, like they had been carapace to allow for the healing of them. But then it was revealed that apparently that no. In fact, that was not the case, and they were still, because they had been regenerated under there, they were still techno-organic.
I always remember that because it was like in, I think, Wizard or something. I can't remember who, but somebody at Marvel said, two things are going to happen. We're either going to get Angel back with his regular wings, or Beast is going to turn into the, you know, shoeless guy from the first issue of the comics. And I guess the Angel wing thing went out over Beast turning back into the, you know, shoeless guy.
And then he regenerated his wings as a consequence of the Apocalypse strain. I don't know what that is, but I would assume that's genetic material extracted from Apocalypse, given that little Apocalypse kid that's running around at the moment. And that transformed him back into Archangel as part of the Dark Angel saga. And then now he's back, but he's had his mind wiped.
Can't wait to read that. Not really.
But Rick Remender's X-Force gets good reviews.
Oh, well. But like I was saying, you know, he's lost his company. The board of directors have taken it away from him, and he can no longer fund the school. So basically, they're losing everything. And this issue, like Wolverine, he's got a plan, I guess. He's going to leave, and he's going to, you know, try to find a way to get some money. So he leaves Iceman in charge while he's gone. And like I was saying, that kind of goes along with the Twitter, because maybe he was tweeting because he was in charge that week or something.
Yeah, it was. Well, the way the Twitter feed was going was something that Kitty was out sick, and so he...
Oh, yeah, and that goes with the issue, too, because Kitty's out sick.
Yeah, she is.
Aw, Kitty's sick.
Well, sick, air quotes.
Oh, no, she's sick, trust me.
Wait, do you need to seek soft kitty tour? That'd be awesome.
But it's, yeah, so, like, Wolverine is, he's got to get some money. He basically goes off into space with Quentin Quire in the issue. And it doesn't really explain why they're going into space, but apparently he's going to help him get some money in space. I don't know.
The adverts for the next issue have suggested that he's going to be using Quentin's telepathy to win at massive alien gambling.
Yeah, it looks like I saw the cover. Like they're at a poker table or something. Yeah.
what's the exchange rate, you know, on space money?
You know, I believe there probably is one, too. I don't know what it is, but I would believe that's something that they have set up with Marvel. Yeah.
But yeah, like, mostly what happens in the issue is the stuff surrounding Kitty, which at the end of the last issue, we get this shock last page, and Kitty has become pregnant in a matter of, like, days. Like, she wasn't pregnant, then days later she's pregnant. What the hell's going on? Is this, like,
she's
her
real
new
cat?
This is, like, her cat. New mutation. This is, like, her second mutation, I guess. She's now pregnant or something. But no, that's not the case. Something far weirder is going on. And we find out in this issue that we basically – remember there was, like, the – it's not a cover, but it's, like, a two-page spread of, like – what's going on in Wolverine and X-Men? We're now kind of getting some of that stuff with Kitty, where we've got like the miniaturized X-Men. Because in this issue, Beast takes the class on a field trip inside of the body of a mutant to basically look at the X gene. And it's just like, you know, just funny little things. Like Kid Gladiator, you know, he's fighting. He says, "Bah, this DNA is weak and flabby. Shi'ar DNA is vastly superior," as he's punching DNA and it's exploding. You know?
My God.
You just get little like this. You find out that the guy that they jumped into for the field trip was Toad. And while somebody was inside of him, they threw up while they were leaving, so Toad has throw up in his mouth. And he's like, "Ooh, somebody threw up in my mouth." Hank is like, "I think some of the kids may have left some of their tablets behind. You know, you'll be okay as long as you pass them in a day or two before they enlarge." You know? It is just like
interesting.
It's again just like getting more just crazy, like, you know, school stuff. It's I mean, like, there's like big things that'll happen, but most of what I like about the book is like, hey, they're going to class, they're just, you know, doing wacky things while they're, you know, having class. Like the issue where Deathlok visited them and told them they're possible futures and how about like the percentage of all of them are going to die. It's just crazy stuff like that. But in this issue, Kitty finds out that, you know, she tells everybody that she's pregnant. She's been like hiding for like a day or so to, you know, keep it from everybody. And you think, oh, you know, she's just pregnant, you know, oh, she's going to be a good mother, and, you know, we're going to take care of the kid, and holy shit, sound an alarm! You know, what's going on? You know, Beast looks at her and says, oh, you've got to sound an alarm, something's going on. She says, what's wrong? You have tiny broods inside of you that are attacking you. Oh my God!
That was on the Twitter feed, because they talked about all the broods that were all over the school.
They
That's
are
awesome.
Eating her from the inside. It's like a nest of them. It's so crazy.
Yummy. That's so nasty. You shouldn't be reading this comic while having your lunch.
It's crazy stuff like that. Everybody's like giving Kid Gladiator a bad time because like while he was inside of Toad when they were doing the field trip, he got attacked by some antibodies, and people are saying that Kid Gladiator is not strong enough to fight off the antibodies. So he jumps in first into Kitty to go and attack the brood by himself. It's just craziness. It's so much fun. I don't know what to say about the book that I haven't already said. Buy this damn book. I'm just saying. It's fun. I mean, oh my God. Like, if you have any interest in X-Men whatsoever, or just craziness, just like, this is the book. This is the book you should be buying. Do it. Please buy this book.
Wait, what book were we just talking about?
Over here. Yeah.
I forgot.
Yeah. And I'm done. That's it.
Okay. All right, then. Nicole.
Okay, well, we were talking about Image earlier, so I'm going to do an Image comic here. It's a new number one that came out. It's called Thief of Thieves. The tagline on it is, there is nothing he can't steal, nothing he can't hide, have, I mean, except for the life he left behind. So.
Oh, I thought it was going to be the human heart.
Oh. Okay, so this is by Robert Kirkman and Nick Spencer. Artist was Sean Martinborough. So.
Now, as I understand it, the thing with this is that this is Robert Kirkman's idea. It actually factors back in quite interestingly to our creator discussion earlier, which is that this is Robert Kirkman's idea, but I believe he's described himself as acting on this book as like a TV showrunner, and then other individuals are actually writing the script.
Yeah, it says right here, story by Robert Kirkman. Writer was Nick Spencer. So
I suppose it's possible we may see more writers cycle in arcs.
And he's also in as created by, so there you go.
Created by Nick Spencer? Or?
Robert Kirkman.
Just by Robert Kirkman.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, like you said, this is one reason why I like to pick up some like Image stuff is because they have different characters coming out. It's interesting to see a new style of or new story come out. Well, our main character is Redman. Of course, he's a thief. If you didn't get that from the title, spoiler. So basically, when you open up the first couple pages, you see him doing kind of like the Mission Impossible thing. He's floating above the ground. But unlike Mission Impossible, things aren't going well for him. He gets caught. So he calls on his partner, a little help here, and they're like, okay, we'll turn off the lights. And he's like, no, don't turn off the lights, you know, because there's tons of people in the room. Well, he gets caught, and what he's basically is doing is stealing jewels from a countess. And so they call the countess in. She does inventory, and her most prized possession is taken. So she finds out that it's this guy that's doing it. She has his thugs pretty much beat the living crap out of him. The sad thing is, within the next page, you find out these two are in it together. So,
right.
So this is kind of like her opportunity to say, yeah, this is going to be fun for me. And so then you get your backstory of how these two actually met. And
this is your obligatory sort of heist movie scenario.
It's exactly it. It has a very Ocean's 11 feel to it.
I was going to say Ocean's 11, but I decided to err on the side of more generic.
No, it had that feeling to me. So you see her, she's trying to steal a car. Unfortunately, it's his car that she's trying to steal, and she's doing a crappy job at it. So he's like, you're doing that all wrong. So he teaches her how to steal a car. The thing is, it gets into a lot of detail, and you're just like, wow, now I could go out and probably do this. Gives her, hey, you got to watch out. If it's an American car, if it's Japanese, there's different ways you got to break into them. And, I mean, it's just fun, their little interaction of how they're stealing this car. So for a few pages, and then she goes to take it to the chop shop, and he's like, whoa, 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 what are you doing? You're not supposed to take it here. So he gives her money, because officially she stole it, so he gives her the money for the car, and he takes it for himself. And then you go back to the present day, where they're having a big celebration because this heist was all his idea, this jewel heist. And basically, at the end of the party, he's like, you know what? Yeah, I did a great job. He's basically saying, I could do this on my own. I quit. And so that's it. So it's very interesting first story because it gets you excited of what's going to be coming up next. Who is this guy? How did he become this way? How did he learn all these things? I mean, if they teach you, I mean, if he has a different, like, how to teach you to be a thief in each story, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah, bit of a hoax.
But the interaction.
If you ever need to steal an Egyptian crown jewel,
there you go. But the interaction between Redman and what's her name, Celia, is awesome. They have this great chemistry even from day one. And the only thing I could complain about is sometimes the inking is a little too dark. I know it's supposed to be kind of dark, but it's sometimes a little too dark. But basically, it's a good first first issue to get you excited about wanting to know more about this guy and this lady. And
so now, is this the story of a master thief who wants to leave the life behind, or is this the story of a master thief who wants to pull one big last job?
You know what? They don't tell you that. Is from the time, you know, that he had a family before. How did he get there? Yeah, and where's he going? You don't know. There's tons of questions, but the thing is, he's a bad guy. This is kind of like the Secret Six thing. He's a bad guy, but you're rooting for him. You know, you want things to work out for him. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with it. Yes, it's a highly recommended first issue. So there you go.
Nice.
It's by Image. So.
Awesome.
Cool.
Good deal. Okay, so we're okay-ish on time, but I'll try to go quickly.
We'll see how this goes.
Yeah. We've got about 30 minutes left, so we'll see how this goes. I'm going to go through these two quick. So I'm going to do two quick reviews because I want to get to both of these issues. One is the Venom, the Circle of Four, which we are calling the new Fantastic Four.
Do you think that was deliberate?
It had to be. I am sure. It's the Circle of Four, you know.
Yeah, well, but that's because there's four of them.
Right, but I'm saying it's the Circle of Four. It's the four of them. You know, it had to be. And
I guess it probably was.
You know, why those particular characters if not, you know?
Well.
You know, it could have been, there's a lot of different characters that this could have been done with that may have fit better. I mean, certainly Venom and Hulk don't fit into the storyline necessarily very well. But nonetheless. So
that's
funny,
considering it's a Venom comic.
So this issue, one thing that we had talked about was the particular, like, I'm fascinated, like, I totally want to, like, interview or read interviews about the evolution of this storyline. Because it, like we said, it just doesn't seem like this is the original format. In particular, because there isn't an issue of Ghost Rider this month, and this is with the Ghost Rider creative team.
The previous issue wasn't. The previous issue was by the regular Venom creator.
Correct.
And this is 13.1. This is the first part. Well, the first
part
point
two.
Issue.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So part two of six. So so this is more of like the art and everything that I'm used to as far as Ghost Rider goes. Guest stars Doctor Strange and Damian Hellstrom. So for just a little bit of this issue. But the bulk of this issue is one, Ghost Rider trying to stop one of the demons from breaking the seal that's keeping hell from spilling out further than Las Vegas. But the other thing is the battle between our heroes and their antithesis. And I mentioned last week that each hero got an antithesis. And this week we actually got to see the struggle between these two. So for Ghost Rider, her antithesis was Iker, which is a sort of white, angelic-looking figure. For X-23, we got X-666.
Oh, I see what they did there.
Which is a blonde...
I bet she's got horns, don't she? Like,
oh, no, no. No, you've got to think. This is the opposite. So she is a blonde, smiling cheerleader. With adamantium pom-poms. For Venom, we have the evangelist, so the preacher. And for the Hulk, we have I'm going to probably say this wrong, but the encephalon, which is a massive brain thing.
Brain thing is awesome.
It's basically, it just looks like a big, walking, massive brain.
So basically they got the leader to fight the Hulk, what you're saying?
It's worse than that. I mean, it's made out of brain. It's all made out of brain.
Nice.
And what's interesting is that not only do they play on, as far as being opposite themes of, you know, the characters, but for the evangelist, they start to play with their mind as well. So the evangelist starts to play on Flash's, you know, fears, his father's drinking and abuse, his being crippled mentally, you know, and so these sort of
those basic fears that are within Flash. For X-666, she plays into all the things that X-23 is not, in the sense that, you know, she has a happy life and a mother and a father, and she's real, and she has, like, a history in a world where X-23 is simply just created. She just kills because that's what she does, rather than, you know, having a sort of a life and being a real person. And so there's a lot of mental attack that goes on with this. One of the more interesting things that I really didn't expect much out of was Encephalon, where, you know, Hulk is actually fighting Encephalon, and he's like, I don't know why you're a big brain, because I'm not that other guy. You know, I'm the smart Hulk. I have a military background. I'm intelligent, except Encephalon has the abilities to sort of telepathically attack the Hulk. And where he's attacking him is his emotions. He attacks not his higher brain functions, but his lower brain functions. So he's making him actually feel emotion. So he makes him feel terror, you know, fear, you know, like he's being attacked by bugs. He tells him experience depression. And so he feels like no one's following his orders and paying attention to him. So it's a more mental attack in the sense of not, you know, being that physical opposite, but being the mental opposite in terms of, you know, Hulk is full of confidence and strength, you know, mental strength and willpower, and he's attacking those foundations rather than in intelligence in that way. It's really interesting. The thing with Iker is that Iker is a human soul, and whereas, you know, the Ghost Rider is this, you know, demonic entity. So it's trying to remember all the, there was not as much fleshed out with that, but actually she ends up beating Iker, and there's an actual person below it, like a human, and that's the whole deal. But anyway, it's interesting. It was interesting to see the play between these antithesis of these different characters. And it's a great cliffhanger because everything is going wrong. You know, Johnny's trying to keep this centrifuge going. He's about to pass out. All of our other heroes are basically at the mercy of their antithesis. So, you know, it's, you know, and even on the other side of the wall, Damian and Doctor Strange are, you know, essentially losing their fight on the other side to keep hell from spilling over. So, great cliffhanger, great movement into the next issue. So,
I'm like, I wish they'd do something with Doctor Strange where he said, like, sorry guys, hope you guys are good. I gotta go. I'm in this other comic. See ya.
I'm doing this other thing. Damian as well. You know, he's been busy. Yeah. He's busy in Journey this week. So, and so the other half of my review, I want to talk about Scarlet Spider, because that's something that got introduced last month, and the second issue came out. We had a lot of questions about where this was going to go, in particular as far as backstory and explanation. So I'll start off with that, which is that there is none. There are no backups, no back information in this. We're all done with that. We're into story, which I'm happy with. That's cool. We have a similar sort of newsprint intro, as we're familiar with in Amazing Spider-Man, where you have like a tablet story and the different things that are going on. A lot of these are from the Houston newspapers. There's one from a couple from Daily Bugle as well. But when we last left Kane, he was on his way out of town. He was like, screw Houston, I'm done. I did my little bit. You know, whatever happens, happens. And just as he's leaving, huge explosion at the hospital, which is what we saw the last issue. And that damned conscious thing that Kane is getting kicks in, and he goes back. He ends up kicking the cab driver out of his cab and goes back because he knows that's where the girl is. And most of this issue is a fight between him and this villain that's been introduced to is like the... He claims to work for some god or something, but needless to say, he just has the ability to manipulate fire into big fire elementals and all kinds of things. Most of this issue is just a fight between him and Scarlet Spider. There's a couple of interesting things in the fight. I have to say, one of the most disconcerting things in this issue is in part of the fight, Kane sort of knocks a police officer out of the way and knocks his gun to the ground. So Kane turns around and picks up a police officer's gun and fires at the villain. I have to say that was terribly jarring.
Yeah.
Because he's wearing a Spider-Man costume, and it's just, it's almost like seeing a Batman carry a gun, even if you knew it wasn't Bruce. You know, it was just like that's not supposed to happen.
Yeah. Now it's just making me want him to shoot like web bullets out of it or something.
Yeah,
but oh, guess,
have, awesome. Okay, it was, have some sort of a stupid accessory.
And there was just no fanfare about it. And I think that's what was so strange, because it wasn't like even a moment's hesitation on Kane's part. He didn't even think about it.
Yeah, Kane wouldn't.
Exactly. And that's what I mean. And that's what I think is great about this, is because this is not Spider-Man. This is Kane. This is the Scarlet Spider. This is a different thing. And, so that particular moment was interesting. Of course, the villain melted most of the bullets before it got to him, even though he did get a bit burned by the metal. But, in the end, Kane ended up wrapping him up in webbing and beating him that way. But at the very end of the issue, he's actually about to leave town again and goes back to the hospital just to make sure that the girl was okay. And as he's checking on her, the police officers come in. And he's like, I don't want any trouble. And they're like, no, we don't either. And he's like, it's okay, I'm leaving. And they're like, really? You should stay.
Oh, really? You know, he's like, oh, okay. So this is a further inversion of the Spider-Man paradigm like we saw last issue, where Kian acted and somebody got hurt. And the way Spider-Man didn't act and somebody got hurt. So now instead of the police hounding him for taking extreme action, that is legitimately interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and not in a really heavy-handed, obvious inversion sort of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, and in fact, like the officer here, he's like, I'm an officer of the law. There's, you know, he's talking about protecting this girl because she's going to have to be deported, but because she's an illegal alien. And he's like, here in Houston, he goes on about how they're not New York. They don't have heroes here. And he says, I'm an officer of the law. There's nothing I can do. Now, a vigilante, that's a different story. So, there is this sort of idea that he does have the law on his side. And so there's a great, end of this where he's standing at the border fence, and he's looking at the other side. And he basically turns around and comes back, and you see him on the top of a building that he was on in the last issue when he first jumped off. And he basically says, well, I'll try it out. I'll see how it works out. And if it doesn't go well, Mexico's right next door.
Dude, I kind of want him to go to Mexico, because I just want to see Spider-Man in Mexico and just fighting people.
Well, and I think that's interesting because I thought when we were pitched this series, as far as when they talked about it, that was the whole deal. He was going to Mexico. It was a little bit of a surprise.
Maybe still it is. Maybe things are going to go south in the next couple of issues.
Oh, well, the next, it says next, everything instantly goes bad. So we'll see. But, I like it. Like I said, there's so many things that can be done differently with this. I mean, one of the things is he has his mask off when the police officers come in. They see his face, which I don't know how that's going to play, because he looks like Peter, which I guess Peter is just a faceless person in New York. So I don't know. But I like it. I like it as a different Spider-Man story. Like I said, there's enough little things that are shocking. And I don't think that's going to paint the whole thing, but it definitely has solidified itself as a different kind of story about a man with spider powers. It just has a different agenda, a different way of looking at the world. So,
so dare I say, does it have legs?
So far. So,
okay.
Anyway,
seriously,
I think so. I might put it actually on my list. I mean, right now it's not on my list, but I might actually add it to my list. I think it might actually go on something I would pick up each month. So if it keeps on the way it's going, I really like the art too. The art's a really nice, you know, kind of straightforward and yet, you know, interesting style. The colors are great on it as well. So
who's the writer? Who's
writing? It's Yost that's doing the writing.
Oh,
and then Stegman on the art. So, yeah.
Oh, we like Stegman.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So
he was the She-Hulk's.
Yes,
he did the She-Hulk's. Yeah, I like that. Art, that was
so,
good.
Yeah, it's great. It's a good creative team. I mean, it's really good. So check it out. All right, Chris McFeely, you have 25 minutes.
Really? That long?
No, you have 20 minutes, really.
I don't make it that long. Because I was going to touch briefly on the Batwoman before I actually talk about the book I'm going to talk to. Because I was just having it sitting next to me, and I was thinking, this is the first issue of a new story and everything, and we should probably pay a little attention to it, since it is a bit of a change, which is that this is the start of the second arc, which is called To Drown the World. And the distinguishing feature of this is that this does not feature art by J. Epps Williams. Amy Reeder is doing the art for this artwork. Presumably Williams will be back to do the art for the next one. And as much as it's presented as the start of a new arc, it is just the next part of the story, continuing the mystery of, well, beginning to explore the mystery of where the woman, the Weeping Woman, came from. It's implied that her creation was deliberately fabricated. And the theory that we talked about previously on the show about urban legends coming to life also is vindicated here as well, whenever it's talked about the... What's her name? What's the character's name? Marrow? Marrow is the character's name. She seems to be a kind of Chinese medicine woman type figure here. I don't know. She's able to bring the woman who dies back to life, Maria, as the Weeping Woman, because people believe that she is real. So it's a bit Terry Pratchett. It's a bit Discworld. But we see this the hooked arm figure from earlier in the first story arc appears again this issue as well. So that does seem to be confirming that that is what's going on. The narrative structure of this arc is also going to be interesting too, because this style is not limited to this issue. It is built around six separate stories. Batwoman's story, Jacob's story, that's Batwoman's dad, Maggie's story, which is Maggie Sawyer, Morrow's story, which is a story about this mysterious woman, Kate's story, which is what Batwoman's doing in civilian identity, and Chase's story, which does not really seem to be Chase's story so much as it is Batwoman being working with the DEO. The thing about it is that none of them are presented in chronological order.
No.
So it's exploring with a story structure in that regard. It's pretty well put together, all told. It doesn't quite seem like something you could hang an entire arc on, though. Feels maybe more like one issue's worth. And definitely the loss of Williams is felt. The slightness of the story stands out all the more whenever you... you don't have his art. Now, not to knock Amy Reeder, however, because...
No, the art's not bad.
Yeah. No.
I mean, she does better in some areas than others. She definitely does her best work. She got a kind of slightly, ever so slight manga edge in certain spots. She does her best work in the scenes with Maggie Sawyer, really. The scene in her office, the scene with her and Kate in their apartment. It's the Batwoman stuff that kind of looks a little off. It's because we have Guy Major on the colors. We don't have Dave Stewart on the colors this time out, and there's a real loss of any kind of consistency in that regard. And there is a tremendous sense, which is rather inescapable, that she is just aping how Williams would have done it to try and maintain.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not so much on the first page, but then you turn to the first double page spread, 2 and 3, and To Drown the World is swooshed across the page, and I'm like, well, that's not your idea. That's just how Williams would have done that.
Well, and you wonder how much is that, you know, his direction as far as...
How much is, you do wonder, but you would like to think that she wasn't being limited in that sense. And I mean, when I talk about the slightness, like, it takes three sets of double page spreads to simply reveal that Batwoman is now wearing body armor.
Yeah.
It's not
a double page.
I have to say that this issue read holy crap fast.
It did, truly.
I mean, I got to the end, I was like, whoa, that's it?
Yeah, simply because your eyes did not linger upon all of the hidden visuals, you know. The double-page spread of Batwoman getting riddled with bullets is a tremendous waste of space. It's not even a shocking image because you know she's fine. It's like Batwoman's costume can stop bullets. Batman's costume can stop bullets, so it's not like I think she's just been filled full of holes here. But then we get another double-page spread of the bullets falling off, and then another double-page spread of her kicking the guy in the face and saying, hey, you have body armor, and I'm like, yeah, I figured that out, 4 pages. Pages bank, thanks, that's great, yeah. And the actual shot, the double page spread of her getting hit by the bullets is just tremendous waste.
Wow. Oh, yeah, it's totally...
It tries to do the little Williams-esque thing where it singles out each of the bullet impacts in a separate panel, which is like a really Williams-y sort of thing to do, but all it does is actually just draw a square box around the portion of the panel in which it is happening. And the whole, well, you know, I'll just hold it up for the viewers at home, you know, there's the left-hand page, and there's the right-hand page.
How much wasted space on that right page? It's just
nothing on the right-hand page.
There's definitely a layout issue, I think, is really what it comes down to.
Her civilian panels are the best. And obviously, like, nobody wants to follow that act, but the slightness of the story has become very apparent. I like the art. I would read her on something else. But,
I'm going to hope that this is not bad, but
my problem with, like, this is the first issue I got. And I was disappointed because, well, like, first issue I started picking up, it's like, you guys are talking about how awesome this book is. And, like, I know the book's awesome. I know it is. And I know the art's awesome. But when I got it, it's like, oh, where's my
JH? I'm going
to
give it a minute.
If you're thinking about picking up the book based on how beautiful you've heard it is, this is not the issue that's going to prove that fact.
But keep going, because this is really the first time that these creators are collaborating. And sometimes when you have someone who's so visually oriented, like J.H. Williams, and then they're having to write a story and get it translated over, you know, to a different artist, that takes a little bit of work. So I don't want to, like, count this out.
No, I'm not counting it out, it's definitely one that's going to read better once completed as well, because the story structure of breaking the story into these six concurrently running, chronologically separate parts is an interesting one, but... it's only really interesting if you manage to do anything with them. And frankly, like, because it's instead of being one story where all the in isolation in this issue alone, instead of being one story where all the parts are twirled around each other, what we've really got here are the starts of six separate stories. Nothing feeds in into one another. Nothing resolves itself in the span of the issue. There is a lot of just like a lot of nothing happening in the issue.
Yeah.
So it's not the best issue of the series so far, and I probably wouldn't be drawing as much attention to it if I was going at the art, but I'm not. So the touch upon Batman, because I only read that in Journey into Mystery this week. So the thing I'm going to talk about is something I read this morning, which it only came out a few weeks ago, but it has just come out from Dark Horse, which is Avatar: The Last Airbender, following Dark Horse's trend for picking up where TV shows left off.
Like Buffy.
Like Buffy and Dollhouse and Angel.
Smallville.
Yeah.
Which Buffy was pretty good this week. It was not bad. I just didn't want to talk about it.
It's a CW show here, basically.
Yeah, basically. So hands up, first of all, hands up if you read Avatar. Or rather, hands up if you watched Avatar, I mean to say.
No.
I've only seen the movie. That's all I know.
I saw that. And I saw the Blue Cat movie. Does that count?
No,
that's not Avatar. Oh,
it's not Avatar. It said Avatar.
Shame and thrice shame. Okay, Avatar was an animated series that ran for 3 seasons on Nickelodeon, fixed length of 3 seasons, 61 episodes on Nickelodeon between 2005-2008. Set in an alternate world where the Earth is broken up into 4 kingdoms of Earth, Air, Fire, and Water. The classical elements. And people are born into these nations with the power to manipulate the elements, and they're known as benders, earthbenders, firebenders, airbenders, whatever. And one individual is born every couple of hundred years called the Avatar, who will have the power to master all four elements and bring balance to the world. When the Avatar disappeared 100 years ago, the Fire Nation was able to conquer much of the rest of the world, throw it out of balance. And then in the present day, whenever the Avatar is discovered, because his young boy was frozen in an iceberg, he must then embark on a quest across the world to master the four elements and save the world from the evil of the Fire King before a comet comes that will grant the Firebenders the power to conquer the entire world. It was, to wow. put it... It was a very Asian influenced, with a lot of all the different bending styles were all based on different real life martial arts with real consultants brought in for the stylistic anime styling, with a depth of character and story that marks it as literally being one of the best pieces of animation to come out of North America in our lifetimes. And I'm not joking. I'm not hyperbole. If you're not watching it, you've missed out completely. That is.
I saw like snippets of an episode, and I didn't even think it was American.
No, you know, it's.
I was thinking it was like
take it for anime. Yes,
like anime or something.
It
yeah.
has the smart Western structure of anime, where it is able to make each episode be a self-contained story with a larger overarching thing that culminates in a multi-part story, instead of how anime tends to be. And this is not a knock on anime, because I like plenty of animes, but how anime tends to be. Where after a while, anime sort of, at the end of finite series, they sort of turn into films that have just been cut up into four or five pieces as it runs along. They just have a different way of telling their story structure because a lot of them are based on mangas or whatever. So, no, Avatar, absolutely one of the single best pieces of animation, boys' adventure animation, animation for kids, notionally for kids, but, you know, all the emotional maturity and storytelling maturity of any of the best stuff put out, animation put out for adults. Absolutely go and watch it. It is well worth your time. I was quite late to the show. I only watched it after the first season had been completed, and I watched all of the first season in one go, followed it up with the second and the third, and I was brought into it by a friend, and would recommend it to absolutely anybody. The film was a despicable abomination. Of
yeah, I was going to ask you about that. That's the thing.
The film is the first 20 episodes, the first season, condensed down into not even 2 hours. Whoa. The film is a clip show, and it doesn't even feel like you don't even need to have watched the series to realize it is a clip show. If you watch it, it feels like a clip show.
I didn't think it was as bad as people made it out to be.
And you need to get out.
All right.
I am wrong. I've been proven wrong, people.
It is a fucking.
Aren't they making a sequel to the cartoon?
Yes, they are. Legend of Korra, which is set. I think it's something in the vicinity of 70 years after the end of the series. Because, hey, you know, spoilers, they saved the day. They saved the world. That's how they saved it. You know, it's a finite length.
I don't have to watch it now. I know everything.
Spoilers.
I hate how things end. Damn it.
The Avatar, the lead character, is named Aang. He is an air nomad, so each of the subsequent seasons is based around water, earth, and fire. As he masters each one of the three elements, lives among each nation and its people, and thwarts the evils of the world with the help of Katara and her brother Sokka, who are members of the Northern Water Tribe, or is it the Southern Water Tribe? Well, one of the Water Tribes, I can't remember off the top of my head. They add a young earthbender to the team, a young blind earthbender to the team in the second season, and they fight against the exiled prince of the Fire Nation, Zuko, who has concern. Well, you know what? To be able to, honestly, to have to talk about this, I need to explain to you that Prince Zuko did eventually rebel against his father and side with Avatar in the course of the adventure, while being he is an exiled prince of the Fire Nation, and obviously turned on his dad in the end. So where this series picks up is following the end of the first series, following the end of the third series, the TV series. First couple of pages, it's a micro graphic novel, 72 pages of story, $10.99. There's going to be a series of these. This is called The Promise Part 1. Starts out with a recreation of the animated series opening sequence, and then it fills in the details skipped over in the sort of montage-y ending that the series had, and then as the celebration is made to prepare for unification, and the conclusion is made that the Fire Nation is now under the command of Zuko as the king of the Fire Nation, they will withdraw their colonies from the Earth Kingdom. And then it jumps to 1 year later. Now, before it jumps to 1 year later, Zuko makes Aang promise to him, the promise, that if he ever sees him becoming his father, if he ever sees him making the decisions that his father did and becoming the tyrant that his father, the Fire Lord, was, he wants him to kill him. You know, for kids. So we jump to 1 year later, in which Zuko is coming under constant assassination attempts for his perceived betrayal of the Fire Nation from his people. And he starts having to make the tough decisions that eventually earn him the ire of all the other nations, and it looks like Aang may actually have to fulfill his promise. By its very nature, I don't think this is ever a story that they could have told on television, because it is very political. It actually... So they're going to withdraw. The basic plan is Fire Nation colonies out, back to the Fire Nation homeland. But some of these colonies have been here for over a century. There are generations of some families of firebenders and earthbenders who have married and had children who are both, or who claim nationality from both lands. And it's not as black and white as in or out, yes or no, bad or good. And these, it actually has to deal with the rather rough political ground of making decisions like these and accommodating both parties while assassination attempts are being made and protesters are rising up and friends are drawn into Marvel team-up style fights wherever they really should just sit down and talk rather than have a big fight. I don't think that just...
Can we all just be friends?
Well, that's basically Katara, what you just did there. It's representative of the intelligence of the animated series in that it never treated its viewers like as if they were stupid. There were some very dark and very mature concepts at work in the animated series, but never really as many sit down and talk it out issues as we find here. So I don't feel like this would have made for a good TV series, but it's the sort of material you can really explore in a fan-targeted series. All the comedy of the animated series is there as well, from Sokka, who is basically, you know, he's the comedy fixture. He's the jokester of the team, because, you know, Katara is a waterbender, and she taught Aang how to waterbend, but Sokka just has a boomerang. Love him. God love him. he is a warrior from his tribe, but he's a bit accident prone and a bit of a doofus. And Toph is the character from the Earthbending Kingdom, who they added in the second season of the cartoon. She is blind, which is just kind of uncommon, you know. And the show, I always thought one of the best things about her character in the show was that was never her thing, was that she was blind at all. She went around barefoot, so being an earthbender, she could always feel vibrations through the earth and in many ways had greater sight than a lot of the other characters in the show. She never let it get her down. Her family, she didn't agree with her family because they wanted to shelter and protect her because of her handicap, but she actually went out and underground wrestled. Because she is one of the greatest... She, in the course of the series, she invents the art of metal bending as an outgrowth of earth bending, and actually, in the intervening year, has opened a dojo to teach the art to other people. So we meet new characters in her students here as well, who feel very at home. You could really hear the voices of these characters in a TV show. They have the voice and the look of the series. It's written by Jean Luen Yang with close... collaboration, as it says on the back here, from the creators of Avatar, Brian Kinitsko and Dante Michael DiMartino. Michael Dante DiMartino, I beg your pardon. With art by Guri Hiru, who I think most people would probably know as the artists of Marvel's recent spate of Power Pack miniseries. Well, I say recent, it was a good couple of years ago now, but they did the assorted manga-looking Power Pack miniseries. So they very much have the look and humor and feel of the series done in every way. It is a year later, so you'll find that a lot of the characters look a little taller, a little older. It's only 1 year, but these are actually quite young characters. So they are at a point in their lives where 1 year will actually produce a noticeable physical difference in them. I have heard a few people comment on that, and it's like, yeah, you know, they're only like 13 years old or however old some of them are. I don't know how easy it is to recommend to anybody who hasn't followed the TV series. It's obvious, I mean, because it is an absolute must-get if you're a follower of the TV series. It's got everything down right. The question becomes, like, I don't know how... Well, no, that's... I was going to say I don't know how much people were clamoring for this, but really... a lot of people were. I mean, one of the great hanging mysteries at the end of the TV series was what happened to Zuko's mother. You know, she was missing, presumed dead, long-standing mystery in the TV show. And Aang did not kill Zuko's father, which because he's never taken a life, which is why the whole issue of being made to promise that is a great challenge for him. But because Zuko's father is still alive, and now the hard choices have to start to get made, it's not a good idea to have a megalomaniacal tyrant locked up next door that you can ask questions of. This is The Promise Part 1 that is continued in Part 2 later on in May. It is... I think all the material is here to pick up and simply understand, but there will simply not be as much appreciation for it if you haven't watched the TV series, but that's strongly recommended as well. It's definitely shooting very, very hard to emulate the TV series, and I wouldn't even go so far as to say emulate. I'd just say it's nailing it, frankly. Although it does result in some rather extended, large panel, almost, you know, manga-style page layouts of large, jagged panels to cover comparatively short actions in battles, which are, you know, simply not as dynamic as they would be if you saw them animated, because beautiful fluid animation was a big part of the animated series as well. But I absolutely enjoyed it, would recommend it to anybody who watched the TV series, and if you didn't watch the TV series, I recommend you go and do that first. So that's a topic.
So that's pretty much anyone on this podcast but you.
Yeah. According to the chat, it's on Netflix and Amazon Prime, yeah. So I've got no excuse. I should be watching it.
We're missing out. We're missing out.
Well, we are not going to have time to get to Journey into Mystery, but I absolutely insist that Chris McFeely read the first page of Journey as a preview. We were going to review this, but we are totally out of time. Needless to say, it's a really fun and interesting issue, but I'll handle the extra line if that's okay. And
I've got the wrong issue in front of me here.
But I absolutely must hear this in Chris McFeely voice.
I got to kind of voice out here. If people are reading this, they should. This is the funnest comic book.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I couldn't.
Oh, my gosh. It's so fun.
Yes. So we did talk last issue, didn't we, about how the Fear Lords appeared? I think we talked about the last issue. No, we didn't really talk about the terror. Well, whatever. We didn't talk about the terrorism myth part one, did we? So there were Fear Lords, and we saw a group of them. And I'm pretty sure the Lurking Unknown was a pre-existing Fear Lord character, but he is a tiny thing, as fear is. And he's covering the... one of the best things about Journey into Mystery is the fact that the writer actually writes the recap page, and it's not a bunch of copy-pasted paragraphs. So although they do copy-paste the art, the Lurking Unknown covers the recap page. So it goes a little something like this.
Fear me, mortals, for I, the Lurking Unknown...
Speak up!
Fear me, mortals, for I, the Lurking Unknown, Sponge of Terror, have seen within these pages a tale so twisted as to inflate my form to colossal proportions. Behold! A world traumatized in the wake of a war of fear, scattered children succumbing to nightmarish comas and dying of dread. Beware the son of Satan as he searches for the cause, leading him to the fallen god city of Asgard. Besmirch Loki, the child prince of deceit, as he suffers his own night terrors of guilt at the death of his brother Thor and the dooming of the cursed seer to hell. Bedarried, as Leia, handmaiden of hell, discovers milkshakes. Read on, for dead gods, shirtless men, cute puppies, bad jokes, bottomless plot holes, and Tarantino ripoffs. Oh, the horror, the horror! By next issue, I shall be positively toddler-sized. The end is knee-high.
I nearly choked when he said, the end is knee-high.
Probably should have explained at the start there that the idea is that the Lurking Unknown grows the more he is feared.
And, of course, it says, Fear Lord shown actual size. This issue is really great. I am sad that we're not going to get to go through it completely.
Never been able to figure out if Damien Hellstrom should be read British or not.
I don't know.
The character is not British, so far as I know. But Warren Ellis had a very defining run on him. And I've always sort of read the character as British. It's a bit of that, you know. What's it he says to Loki at the very end, you know, stay calm, Loki. It's a nightmare. A load of fear. A load of dream. A Reich. I better not say that. it's that use of a right. That's a very British, British, you know.
People need to just go read this because of Undead Thor.
The Undead Thor is in this. That's a great moment. A great, you know, there's some really nice Loki moments, of course. I mean, as there always are, but some
interact
really
interact with the caption boxes.
I laughed out when Leah said that she didn't mind him not wearing a shirt. That was
I think especially the interacting with the caption boxes, I think definitely plays on some of those elements that we've talked about. You see in this, which is that story, you know, the story element of it. Dealing
you say,
with
no, that's not what's happening. Why the leather shirt and the why the leather trousers and the lack of shirt? I like the lack of shirt. He's got a certain reputation, you know.
Yeah, it's great.
There's another one. He tries to go into Loki's head and he says, "Whatever it is, I can't shift it." Really British sounding. I don't know.
Yeah. Sounds good. Anyway, you should be reading this if you're not. We can't say enough
about
it.
We've told you enough.
So good.
Yeah, but the title page alone, if that doesn't just sell you, O-M-G.
Oh, yeah, and Loki grabs the border and tears it up because they're saying bad things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I mean. It's just like tears the caption box down.
I love it when things break the fourth wall.
Do yourself a favor and read this.
So. See, I've read Deadpool for so long that breaking the fourth wall does nothing for me anymore. But that's almost not really breaking the fourth wall. It's a very it's something that Journey into Mystery hasn't done before. But an idea that riffs on the established concepts of the book, so it doesn't feel out of place at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Works either way.
All right. Well, we have talked so much. Again, if you have any hate mail, please send it to TFG1Mike. At GeekCastRadio. Thanks so much for joining us, and please tune in next time when it'll be Fanboy versus.
This has been Fanboy versus. Visit us at tfradio.net for show notes and to subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter at tfradio for news and updates. Like the podcast? Leave us feedback on iTunes. Copyright 2011, Radio Free Cybertron.